Welcome to Consider the Constitution, the podcast that cuts through the noise and provides insight into constitutional issues that directly affect every American. Hosted by Dr. Katie Crawford Lackey and featuring interviews with constitutional scholars, policy and subject matter experts, heritage professionals, and legal practitioners, we examine the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. Consider the Constitution is brought to you by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
Hello, and welcome back to Consider the Constitution. I'm your host, Dr. Katie Crawford Lackey, Director of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. In the aftermath of the American Revolution, the new country faced a major financial crisis. And today we're going to do a deep dive into the economic views of the founding era. Declaring independence from Great Britain in 1776, the former colonies created a new government under the Articles of Confederation. The country was structured as a confederate of sovereign states, with a weak central government composed of one branch, Congress. Under the Articles, Congress was powerless to levy taxes or regulate trade, which created significant economic instability as America emerged triumphant from the Revolutionary War in 1783. Now, James Madison recognized the weaknesses of the Articles of Confederation and proposed the creation of a new government that today we know as federalism. While we often consider the government structures debated in the summer of 1787 in Philadelphia, perhaps we overlook the economic debates and economic impacts from that constitutional convention. Some of the questions we may have include, how did this constitution address economic turbulence that threatened in the aftermath of the Revolutionary War? What was the relationship between politics and markets at the time? And what does that look like today? To help us answer some of these questions is Dr. Danielle Charette, the Associate Director for the Program on Constitutionalism and Democracy at the University of Virginia. She is an Assistant Professor of Politics at the university. Her research focuses on tensions between Republican institutions and the emergence of political economy in the 18th century. Welcome, Danielle. It's wonderful to have you here today.
Thanks, Katie. I'm really excited to be here at Montpelier.
I want to get started by discussing this tension that some of the founders had regarding economics and how they were going to mitigate this situation. So what kind of economic theory are they discussing during the Constitutional Convention? What sources or principles are they looking to as they have these debates that summer?
Sure. So there are a number of sources that the founders are drawing upon, mixing, adapting as they think about how they're going to get this constitution off the ground. I would just throw out a few real heavy hitters in the sources, all of whom show up in some form in the Federalist Papers. So we know that they're foremost on some of the founders' minds. One would be the French theorist Montesquieu, author of The Spirit of the Laws. Americans tend to just think of Montesquieu vaguely as, oh, right, he was the great theorist of the separation of powers. So that's not wrong, but what it's also important to understand is that Montesquieu is this theorist of commercial government. How is modern commerce possibly making governments more peaceful? How is it changing the spirit and the assumptions of the laws? How is it redefining maybe the possibilities of modern republics? So that's going to be a factor in some of the founders' minds. Two other sources I'll throw out there are the Scotsmen, David Hume and Adam Smith. So Hume's essays are circulating very widely in the 1760s and 70s, and he's writing about modern commerce, modern balance of trade, encouraging nations not to be too aggressive toward one another. It's better to be cooperative than to be using commerce as some imperative toward war. And then finally, Smith. It's not an accident that the Declaration of Independence and the Wealth of Nations share the same birthday. The Wealth of Nations is published in 1776. So those are some background sources that I would recommend and that the founders themselves recommended. In terms of dealing with this big picture debt issue, the Constitution touches on political economy in a few different places. So the first would be Article 1, Section 8. So Congress is being told, okay, you can lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, excises, And it's Congress's job really to collect taxes and provide for the common defense. That was a real shortcoming of the Articles. So borrowing money, coining money, these are going to be national powers, not left to the states. Another place that we find this hint of political economy is going to be in Article 1, Section 10. Congress is saying, you know what? The states can't impede the enforcement of contracts. Now, all kind of contracts are going to be on the table, but what kind of contracts in particular? Economic contracts. And then finally, this is a little less explicit, but you can think of the court system that's set up in Article 3 as a way that Madison and Hamilton are trying to get around state courts that might be seen as too favorable to debtors. That's not necessarily the main motive of the judicial branch, but that's going to be a component that you're going to have a judiciary to enforce contracts.
Thank you for pointing out these aspects of the Constitution where we start to see economic provisions being made. Danielle, you mention one of these heavy hitters, Adam Smith and his Wealth of Nations. What is so significant about Smith and this writing?
Well, I think Americans should take a certain level of pride in Smith because he's fascinated by Americans. The book takes a while to come out because Smith is spending more and more time in London. He's Scottish, but he moves to London in 1773 for the time being, partly because that's where you go to get all the news of what's happening in the colony. So he's consuming all of these reports and is just really beholden to international affairs. This is the big international event of the day. And while Smith is in London, that's when we're seeing the Boston Tea Party, the Quebec Act, the first shots fired at Lexington and Concord. And his friends are saying, look, you need to stop being so distracted by America. You've got a book manuscript to get out. Come on here. Hume is writing to him and saying, if you wait for this matter of America to be solved, you're going to wait way too long. And of course, The Wealth of Nations is a huge book. It's about a lot of things. But one thing it's about is the relationship between the mother country and the colonies. This idea that economic growth isn't zero sum. The danger of public debts run amok, just the enormous expense of trying to keep America inside the imperial fold. So America becomes this case study in some of the abuses of the British Empire, and Smith is ultimately advocating for Great Britain to let America go. Not necessarily because he's a natural rights theorist, not even because he prefers democracy to monarchy. It's not clear to me that Smith does. He doesn't have a critique of monarchy as a form of government. He does have a critique of trying to maintain the colonies as a part of this huge and unwieldy empire. So you can see why he's so excited, fascinated, maybe even a little distracted by American events. And that's why it takes him a while. And lo and behold, The Wealth of Nations is published in 1776. As you might imagine, Americans are very excited about this book. So Americans make up some of Smith's most enthusiastic readers. We know that Hamilton was preparing his own commentary on The Wealth of Nations. We know that Madison and Jefferson are going to recommend The Wealth of Nations to Congress, to the library. We know that where I teach, the University of Virginia, is one of the first places in North America to be actually offering political economy as a subject that the founders of the university think are worthy of higher education. That's unusual. Not just studying Latin, Greek, theology, but to say political economy, there's a branch of higher learning. I would really recommend Glory Liu's new book on Adam Smith's America. She's great at documenting all of this fascinating reception of Americans in particular, reading Smith, using Smith, occasionally abusing Smith, trying to adapt his views to ours, but they don't always read Smith consistently, but they're excited about Smith. Franklin is going to be an acquaintance of Smith's. There's some speculation that Franklin might have even read drafts of The Wealth of Nations while he was over in Britain.
I can see Adam Smith in London just a couple of years before the Declaration of Independence. That must have been a fascinating time to be consuming news about what's happening in the colonies. And there's obviously a relationship between what Smith is seeing in the newspapers about kind of this turbulence that you reference in the colonies and how that's informing what he's writing. Danielle, you reference that James Madison is reading Wealth of Nations. You also reference Alexander Hamilton. We know from past episodes that while these men were friends and cohorts, they do begin to deviate on their political vision for what America is going to look like. How does the economy play a factor in that and Hamilton's role in creating the First National Bank?
Sure. So political economy is going to be a source of enormous disagreement after the Constitution is passed, largely because, of course, people disagree about their economic vision. But also important is political economy is going to shape how the Constitution is interpreted. The stakes are actually quite high. Are we going to see the Constitution loosely? Are we going to be really firmly held down by the actual text of Article 1, Section 8? Are you allowed to say anything's necessary and proper? If something's convenient, does that mean it's necessary? Jefferson and Hamilton are going to disagree about that. So really, the stakes are clear by Washington's presidency. Already then, people are fighting, and you can see this in Washington's cabinet. Between Hamilton, on the one hand, who's quite excited to see a national bank, he thinks it's important for the national government to absorb and assume state and foreign debt. He thinks we should really be sponsoring manufacturing to become the kind of country that can invest, expand, and also get our fiscal house in order to be responsible in terms of our credit and to be respectable. He often uses the word embarrassed, this embarrassment of our debt situation. That comes up in the Federalist Papers and also in these various reports on manufacturing and banking that Hamilton is writing. Jefferson, though, is not embarrassed by the same things Hamilton is embarrassed by. What Jefferson is embarrassed by is he thinks that Hamilton's fudging the Constitution. He's implying powers that Jefferson doesn't see written in the texts. Jefferson is not as enthusiastic about growth, manufacturing. He's concerned about virtue, farming. He says, what's America's comparative advantage? It's in the land. Let's look to agriculture. Let's not look to just precedents in Great Britain. There's a reason we fought the Revolution. Why would we immediately want to ensnare ourselves to banking and credit and debt? For Jefferson, this is a recipe for tyranny. So already, those are the lines in the sand. You have Hamilton on one side, Jefferson on the other. Madison is kind of caught between the two. Remember, Hamilton's his former co-author in the Federalist Papers. They really took responsibility together for the Constitution, and I said a few minutes ago, there are these provisions to try to get America's fiscal house in order in the Constitution. And in that sense, you would think Hamilton and Madison are in agreement. But Madison is more sympathetic to Jefferson's agricultural vision, less enthusiastic about manufacturing in the Northeast. He agrees with Jefferson, too, that the Constitution ought to mean maybe what it says it does. He's less comfortable with Hamilton's extensive view of executive power and his excitement and even tolerance for debt and banking, calling it a national blessing. I don't know that Madison would ever quite go that far. So Madison's presidency becomes a place to test these ideas and again is compromising. So Madison offends some of the hardcore Jeffersonians because he does oversee the rechartering of the bank. Also, we see the tariff of 1816. And why do we see this? It's because of the War of 1812. Some Jeffersonian principles are maybe now impractical. Even people who think of themselves as Jeffersonians, so I'm thinking of Henry Clay, even John Calhoun, they're basically on the same side during the War of 1812, both thinking of themselves as nationalist Republicans to a certain extent. So yes, agriculture is important, but so is infrastructure. And they're tolerating the tariff, maybe making their peace with the bank, or at least Clay does, seeing it as a necessity of building a prosperous republic that's reliable, dependable, and can fight its wars. Jefferson was an agrarian, but he also took for granted that we would be able to trade pretty freely with Great Britain. But if they're attacking our ships, if we're becoming embroiled in the Napoleonic Wars, maybe we're going to have to build some things ourselves at home.
This is a fascinating time period that you're referencing, from George Washington's presidency. We then have John Adams, followed by Thomas Jefferson. And that's the period when Madison is the Secretary of State under Jefferson from 1801 to 1809. As you reference, there's concerns about manufacturing, as well as, you know, America is still an agrarian society, but industry is a concern, especially in urban areas in the North. Under Madison's presidency, we also have westward expansion, increase in trade, and we have the institution of slavery. Obviously, this land that is being cultivated largely by enslaved people. How do all of these economic factors influence what it means to be American as this young country is developing its own identity?
Well, I think it's very much contested between Hamilton's vision doesn't go away, Jefferson's vision doesn't go away, Madison's attempt to maybe triangulate between the two is very much live. In terms of American identity, by the 1820s and early 1830s, you have someone like Henry Clay saying, you know what, I'm going to create a system. In fact, it's an American system. It's not just going to be on behalf of the North or the South, but increasingly looking west to our canals, roads, infrastructure. And he's saying that's going to unite the whole country. Now, other people are going to look askance at that and say, well, you say it's an American system, but maybe this is to benefit your home state of Kentucky. Or you say this is going to be for all citizens, but it seems to us that a really high protective tariff is going to advantage wealthy business interests. So that's a contested definition of America. At the same time, you have Clay's rival, John C. Calhoun. He's going to say that he speaks for the people. In fact, the people are sovereign. The sovereignty of the people is behind all government. But when he speaks of the American people, you have to wonder, is he speaking of everyone, or is he just speaking of plantation owners in South Carolina? So all of these different visions that get caught up in political economy, you can trace people's different interests, their different priorities. Are they favoring the rich or the poor? Are they favoring their home state, the entire nation? I mean, it's difficult to keep track of, but these issues are all continue to be in play, and I wouldn't say they're really resolved. They just kind of morph and are carried forward.
Jumping forward in time to look at another significant period of economic growth in America is this period we refer to as the Gilded Age. So this is 1870s through early 1890s, roughly. And this is a period characterized by expanding industrialization, the rise of big business, all of which is spurring immigration to the U.S., and is incentivizing people to move from rural areas to urban cities. And these conditions facilitate, in part, the mass exploitation of workers. And these workers are facing harsh conditions, low pay, and so we see social reform movements spring up in response. Progressives are responding to what they see as growing class stratification. So what is causing this economic boom at this period in time? How is it redefining the country? And what does the relationship look like between the individual, the state, and capitalism during this period?
So the short answer, I think, to the boom, and there are lots of debates around that, but I think the shortest answer, maybe the crispest way to understand where all of this innovation and wealth and inequality come from, is just that after the Civil War, the national government is asserting more uniform sovereignty over the states. And that more uniform, stronger assertive sovereignty is coupled with incentives for industrial development. Going in particular, you can think of the railroads. So a stronger national government, incentives for westward expansion, that's allowing both the vertical and horizontal integration of firms, railroads. Think of these titans of industry like Cornelius Vanderbilt, later Andrew Carnegie, taking advantage of this expansion, and they're going to show the possibilities of growth. capitalism, but also inequality. One of the fascinating features of American political economy in particular is that the 19th century is really the first time in the history of the world where you have two phenomena intersecting. So you have capitalism on the one hand and democracy on the other, coming together, fighting with each other, but coming together and coexisting, intersecting at the same time. Democracies have existed before. Democracies were present in ancient Greece, in particular Athens. And capitalism has been developing before the United States. It's present in 17th and 18th century Europe, in particular Great Britain. But Athens wasn't capitalistic, and Britain wasn't particularly democratic. The United States is the first time we see democratic ideas alongside capitalist ideas. But one way to approach the Gilded Age is to think some people don't necessarily assume that capitalism and democracy should be side by side. So you can see reformers saying, you know what? The emphasis should be on democracy, not capitalism. So later in the early 20th century, we're going to see social reformers like Jane Addams or John Dewey saying it's capitalism that's the problem, not democracy. Let's have pragmatic experiment. Look to the cities. Let's look to ordinary people for practical solutions. On the flip side, you'll see people who say it's democracy that's the problem. Let's have more capitalism. You see this in the writings of academics like Sumner. You see this in businessmen to a certain extent, like Andrew Carnegie. And they're articulating to various extents a view of social Darwinism, a view that capitalists have won some evolutionary race and then ought to be able to showcase this wealth that they've earned through just the sheer force of competition. And if they give it away through, say, Carnegie's Gospel of Wealth, that should be at their discretion and not the government's. They say the capitalists, rather than the Democrats, should be the ones who forge the way. And then, of course, there are lots of people trying to figure out compromises between these two systems. I think that's one way you could understand a figure like Theodore Roosevelt or Woodrow Wilson, where they're saying, in the name of democracy, we also need to have a government that can compete and industrialize and streamline administration at the same level as capitalist firms.
You've introduced us to this fascinating idea that democracy and capitalism are existing within the same country at the same time, which has not happened before. What lessons can we glean from that today as we kind of assess where we're at as a society, both in terms of our democracy as well as where we are with our economy in this capitalist society?
I find American political economy interesting because I think it actually makes American history, and maybe in particular the Founding Fathers, more approachable. At first, that might not be the case. You might pick up Hamilton's report on public credit and think, what's going on? This is boring. I didn't take up an interest in constitutional studies for this. But if we actually think about the present, it becomes more approachable. Everyone has economic opinions. You might not even have thought about them in explicitly political terms, but think about it. People have competing opinions about inflation or interest rates or what the appropriate political response to COVID was. And so if we have all of these opinions and all of these economic fights that we're walking around with every day, it's completely logical that people throughout American history have also had economic preferences or economic policies that they wanted to implement. So you can look at the debates between, say, Hamilton and Jefferson and think, oh yeah, that makes sense that Hamilton is excited about urban industry. You can say it also makes sense, oh, Jefferson is really worried about what too much industry might do to our character. He thinks it's better to be more rural, more agrarian. He thinks that's more democratic. Those are the more common Americans. They're farming. They're not as distracted by big city concerns. And you can see Hamilton saying, no, the big city is where immigrants are. That's where dynamism is. That's where innovation is. And you can say, okay, well, looking at that from an economic lens, that kind of makes sense. So I think political economy, too, is a way to capture that the founders disagreed fiercely with one another. And this is something where they were never on the same page. Even as I said, these former co-authors, Hamilton and Madison, immediately they're going to disagree about the economy. Immediately, people are going to think that President Washington is being duped by Hamilton's economic policies. Immediately, people are going to think Jefferson's out of touch because of the embargo of 1807. So I think if you're fond of the founding fathers or suspicious of them or wondering about their different opinions, political economy can be a nice way of teasing out some of their founding principles hitting the ground and needing to become more practical.
Your point about incorporating economy and looking at how these theories developed at the founding era up through the present, I think is a very powerful one. It's a more interdisciplinary way of looking at history. And it explains what people's motives are, people in power, those who are making policy, both then and now. And it just gives us a much more accurate and holistic image of what American history is and what it means to be American. And I want to thank you for coming here today and sharing your knowledge with us. It was a pleasure to talk with you, Dr. Charette.
It was wonderful to talk with you as well. Thanks for having me.
And I want to thank all of our listeners for tuning in today. Please share the show with your family and friends. And join us again in 2 weeks as we consider the Constitution.